Blake Murphy is here. What's up, buddy?
Hey, man.
Nice shirt.
Thank you for wearing Jaguars. You too. Thank you for wearing Jaguars colors. So
always for you. Yeah, you know.
Also, you look very lean right now.
Yeah, thank you. I'm back on dieting and working out, so that means a lot for you to say that. I'm not good at the getting the sleep part of it, though.
Mm.
The dieting I can do, the working out part I can do. It's the all the gym bros going, what you need, bro, is your 8 hours. Sleep is crucial.
Those bros don't have a 9 a.m. radio show that requires you to be up until 1 a.m. watching sports.
I wish I could just purely blame the sports. I love watching late night hoops, especially because my Sacramento Kings play late at night.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched that last night too. It was a fun game between the Knicks and Blazers I threw on. I went, yeah, I'll delve into a little bit of this. Watch a little bit of Flames choke against the Coyotes, which is just...
The Calgary Flames choking one away?
They're just tragic.
Wow.
It's a tragic team. And it makes me sad because Kadri went there and they got screwed over by their star players. And they had an offseason where I went, they salvaged this.
Mm-hmm.
And then nothing. And last night wasn't even Markstrom's fault. They just sucked. They just suck. They're awful. I like when the Canadian teams are good. And I've always had, I would say, out of all my softest spots for other Canadian franchises... Calgary's always been one because when I was a senior in high school, they went on that cup run. And that was just really fun, watching all those games. And yeah.
Plus, who doesn't love Iginla?
Yeah, exactly. It was the well, they were the underdog team. Iginla fought every single round. Marty Jelena had all these big goals. It was just a really, really fun playoff run. Kiprusoff was amazing. And then, yeah, now they're just a tragedy. Anyway, we won't talk hockey with Blake Murphy, but yeah, thank you for saying I look lean. I appreciate that very much. So I do want to talk to you a little bit about the Raptors today, but first, what's your level of interest in the Canada baseball game today after watching Otto Lopez go yard to win 5-0? I thought I didn't care. And then I watched the first game and I kind of cared. And then I went, I'm going to watch the USA game. And then I couldn't because when Leafs talk ended, it was already 9-0. And then I kind of reluctantly put the Columbia game on, and it was 1-0 for a very long time, and it was sort of background stuff. And I figured Columbia was going to come back and that Canada was going to pay for not putting up any runs. And then they go up 2-0. Freddie Freeman gets hurt. And then I'm sitting there going, guys, close this out. I can't remember the pitcher's name who came in for the 8th inning for Canada with the long hair.
Mm.
You know who I'm talking about?
Yes, but I was watching on silent in the Raptors
I don't
media
know his
room.
Name.
So I...
But he has two huge punch outs, and I'm screaming, let's go. We're doing this thing. Now it matters. Now it's real. Then Canada gets into the 8th, and... Or I guess... No, that was the 9th, right?
Well, 8th they tacked one on, and then 9th was when they
ninth
really poured it on.
When he poured it on, right. So, sorry, 9th inning, bang, Otto Lopez, 3-run jack. Earlier in the day on this podcast... Old Betty Nicholson Smith told the audience that he thought Otto Lopez was the story of spring. And now I'm convinced that was the most seal the deal. He said that. He's like, Otto Lopez. I went, I was kind of hoping that you were going to say something different about Bo Bichette's routine coming into camp. You know, I was looking for one of those answers. He gave me Otto Lopez. I was a little bummed out. Now I'm basically... I'm trying to carve a space as one of Otto Lopez's biggest fans, biggest believers. I'm into it. But yeah, Mexico today at 3. All of a sudden, Blake, you're kind of a traitor because you posted one of the Mexican players wearing luchador masks.
Yeah, Randy Rosarena.
Indicating you are of split allegiances. But yeah, I like, who do you care more about today, Mexico or Canada?
Oh, obviously Canada, but yeah. I care more about wrestling than anything else.
Yeah,
so
that's true. Like, that's where you really are from.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, this is kind of exciting, though, eh? Like,
big time.
I love how I threw in this talking
and
about
like,
Canada baseball.
So Trevor Bridgen, by the way, is the pitcher who threw yesterday. But Canada's in a good spot here where obviously Mexico's going to be very, very difficult.
Yeah.
There'll be the underdogs in this game. But you look at who they've used. Like Canada had as the 4 seed this kind of difficult setup where you play 4 days in a row and there's so many rules around when pitchers can throw and how much. You're not really, because Skiro gave you such a good outing yesterday and because the game before that was such a wash,
mm-hmm.
like just... flush it. You have all the important bullpen arms that you would have been hoping to lean on ready to go today.
Mm.
So you've got our guy Axford and Philippe Beaumont.
They're the important guys?
I mean, they're the like fifth,
that's
sixth inning guys.
That's not good.
They're the guys who could hit 95.
I made this joke yesterday, but it's not great having guys older than me on the team.
Yeah, guys who, I mean, you've been in a pit with Axford before, probably at some show or another. Yeah, it's not great, but they're in a good spot today. And Mexico is obviously, they're Mexico and it's baseball. It's a huge thing. The other thing that we have going today is like, there are scenarios where Canada doesn't win and still makes it in if they get help. That Colombia team could theoretically beat the U.S. and then you get into a that convoluted multi-team tiebreaker.
That shouldn't be allowed. If you beat a team by the amount of runs that the USA beat Canada, you're just out.
So like, I agree with you. And I think the way that they do it is silly. And mercies would be a normal thing to do if you really don't want to. Like, they got rid of, or they introduced a mercy rule because Canada beat the crap out of teams that blew them out. Like, yeah, physically, they would just get in fights with them.
Yeah, which that's is actually the cool thing about this game is that, do you remember, I don't know how many years ago this was. This was maybe
5. Because
no,
it got bumped.
Be more.
What was the last one, 2016?
I don't, or 2017? No. There's been some since then. But there was the most famous World Baseball Classic was Team Canada gets in a fight with Mexico.
Mm-hmm. Where, yeah, so the last one was 2017.
That was the last time there was World Baseball
because
Classic?
Of the, yeah, it was supposed to be 2021 and then the pandemic and then last year they didn't want to do it. 2013 was the brawl.
I was going to say it felt but way further back.
I don't
that.
Know if anyone other than Axford off of either team would have been there.
No. Maybe Lowen.
Maybe.
Yeah, Adam Lowen I think would have been there. But either way, little bit of history.
Yeah.
Rich rivalry.
But the tiebreakers are so goofy, though.
We're like, in it with Mexico in sports right now, though. We beat them in soccer. They never thought that. Now, all of a sudden, we might beat them in baseball with our Bad News Bears assembly of just
you
whatever,
get Great
guys.
Britain out of that pool, and that's the Copa America's pool right there is
really
what that is.
Great Britain. They're having a tough go with the jerseys, huh?
Lowen was there in 2013.
Nice. Yeah. Good ball.
See? Look at that.
Yeah, who else was it? Well, that would be a roster of remember some guys that we like hoped would even stick on Major League. We're like Pete Orr in there throwing bombs.
Pete Orr was the man. The reason why I remember Adam Lowen on that team, though, is because he's huge and looks like a Viking. And yes, I remember thinking, you better not let him hit one of those guys.
Well, if you brought out, like, let's play out the scenario where that happens today. Lowen, Axford, and Oman are like probably 6'7". The three biggest guys in the tournament.
Yeah.
And they're all like old and look like they've had enough of everyone's crap for a lifetime.
I was gonna say that sounds good until you remember everybody's old and then they throw one punch and they go, oh my God, my shoulder just popped out.
But maybe one's all you need.
Yeah, it's true. That is one that all you need. So the Otto Lopez thing, you think this is a real Blue Jay story now then too? You're on the wagon?
I do. And I asked Shai about it at the onset of the tournament. Like, do we read anything into it that he's there? Because if I'm competing for the final roster spot, I don't know if I want to go, right? And I'm probably trying to have honest conversations with the front office and with John Schneider about, hey, does me going, even if I kill it, does that hurt my chances of making the roster because I'm not physically here? If I go there and I'm just average and you completely forget about me, like, are my chances completely tanked? That's what I would have worried about. He's been so great, and like, they're using him all over the diamond, exactly how the Jays would want to. I know that, like, they've joked on the broadcast a couple times, oh, he's 6-for-9 in his major league career. He very clearly has, like, good bat-to-ball skill. It's, like, I think he is pretty easy to project into the last spot on the roster role. Like, good guy that apparently everyone really loves. The organization likes the way he, like, approaches every day and the kind of, you know, leadership as far as a 24-year-old with no service time can provide that. And then you've also got supreme positional versatility and a guy who, like, has a plan at the plate. He's almost the exact opposite of Bradley Zimmer in that he's not going to have elite defense at any one position probably, but he does everything else so well, whereas Bradley Zimmer was, like, only the one thing and did everything else so poorly.
Yeah. I don't know enough about Otto Lopez to really have the strongest opinion. All I will say is that when you and BNS and others talk about, hey, a guy who can play all over the diamond and who can provide some flexibility, if he is good, if he's decent, that should put a decent amount of pressure, I think, on the Whit Merrifield and Kevin Biggio's of the world.
And Santiago Espinal, who's having a great spring, but we saw him start hot last year and then cool off.
The only thing with Espinal, why I wouldn't feel as threatened, is because the glove is something where you feel like you want to have him around more than the other guys, because in defensive situations this year, they're going to want to put him somewhere on the infield.
Oh, he's on the he's at second base to close any close game, and if Bo were to have to miss a day, like, he is probably the only guy you trust.
Yeah, but that's the thing. And so we're watching spring training, and I'm trying to, this is always weird because I love having takes early on in the year. This is the best. But then you really have to temper yourself because baseball is a sport where these guys are actually going to have 3 months into the regular season, and you're going to have the Blake Murphys of the world telling you, you can't have a take because this it's not the sample yet, right?
Nah.
I know. You're not really that guy. But the analytics of the sport and the smarter thing is not to lose your mind based on a small sample.
Here's the thing with the Otto Lopez's of the world, though, is you're never going to get that sample, right?
Sure.
Show me the bench guy that gets enough samples.
Sure.
So I think taking advantage of the small windows of opportunity you have is actually a really important thing in this role, not only to get the role, but like, you know, it's like a guy who comes in as the Joe Wieskamp, right?
Yeah.
If you come in and you go 3 for 3 on threes, you'll probably get another shot. If you go 1 for 3, you're never seeing the court again.
Yeah.
So you kind of have to hit your shots if you're Otto Lopez. And I think, you know, I know none of us are watching like a ton of New Hampshire Fisher Cats games, a Buffalo Bisons game. I think I saw him 3 or 4 times with Buffalo last year. And the numbers are like pretty solid. Like he's a guy who takes a lot of walks, doesn't really strike out. The small sample stuff, whatever. You're like Bradley Zimmer was on the roster the whole season last year and had like 100 plate appearances.
My point, I guess, is that we remember Whit Merrifield finishing the season very strong. But now what I'm seeing down at spring is even with the bigger bases, he's getting punched out a lot. And I'm sure they're being more aggressive and they're trying to steal bases in some spots they wouldn't. But he's 34 years old and he started off here ice cold. And there was sort of this assumption that he was going to be the fourth outfielder slash get some infield time slash be a little bit more regular than you thought he would be. And then same goes for Kevin Biggio, where, and I know he hit a huge home run the other day and people went, it was on a fastball. It was on a 96 mile per hour pitch. So Kevin Biggio has changed.
That kind of talk, I think, is generally not a red flag, but like a yellow flag where if you are lowering the bar so much for a guy to make the case for him. I think Kevin Biggio is a perfectly fine kind of utility piece. If this team wasn't weirdly now like pretty left-handed heavy in the spots that Kevin Biggio might play, like he's a really useful guy to have around. But yeah, if you're lowering the bar to, oh, well, he did this against this specific pitch. Yeah, you are 28 years old in like your 100th MLB season at this point, sneakily. You should be able to hit a fastball.
I guess this is sort of where I was going with it is if you were going to have someone who you needed to be able to platoon around, I think there might be a case that Otto Lopez is a better defensive player than Kevin Biggio is because he's not a good defensive player. And now all of a sudden, if you're looking at depth guys who do this, you might have more value in the right-handed guy. It's just a weird thing as a Blue Jays fan to set your mind to that they're already going to have potentially looking at Addison Barger, looking at, you know, Brandon Belt and this thing. That Kevin Biggio being left-handed doesn't matter as much anymore.
It was his only path in the lineup last year.
It was his number one thing. And they
and like if you're trying to find where he'll get his plate appearances, right? It's like, okay, if you're facing a lefty, one of Kiermaier or Varshall will probably come out. Like, I don't think they're a straight platoon, but I would imagine one of them comes out each game against lefties, and then Merrifield moves to left field, Espinal gets second base that day. There's no Biggio spot there. Mm-hmm. So where is he getting his reps? Okay, if against the righty, one of those guys needs a day off, and then the Springer DH days, maybe he's getting first base when Vlad is down. I don't really know if they intend to ever ask Brandon Belt to play first base, but everyone could play first base is the thing.
Yeah.
So he's basically the George Springer caddy at this point against right-handed pitchers.
Yeah, I don't.
And again, I like Biggio. I think he's a useful guy.
You don't have to like everyone, all right?
But
like,
I think he's the nicest guy ever. I think he's fine.
You and Pete on the other side of the table is the what's the good side called in Star Wars? All I know is I'm the dark side.
You're asking the wrong
people.
The Jedi,
light side.
Oh. Yeah, but is it? It's not called the light side. No, it's not.
The Force?
I don't know. No, I know. That's why my brain went the Force and to the Jedi as well. I know stuff about Star Wars, all right? Nobody freak out in my mentions.
But you know, like you've watched The Good Place?
Yeah, of course.
Okay.
Awesome.
So we're on the...
What happened to that show? Is it gone? Is it done?
Yeah, it like completely wrapped up. Like the series finale was like bow on everything.
I think maybe it tailed off then because
they should run it back as an anthology style show where it's just like the the fake good place, and they're just messing with people. And like, we don't need to be invested in the characters. Just like run the plays that you were doing to torture people.
You guys are really distracting me, because now I want to have a conversation about Ted Danson's career and how it's like, how many people would you trade places with in terms of like who you could be for his entire life?
He's the man. And have you watched Poker Face yet?
Yeah.
Yeah. So
he's in Poker Face?
No, but there was an interview with the showrunners and they got asked who their like dream guest stars are for season two, and Danson. They were like, oh, we're making the calls to try to get Danson in there. Anyway, all I was going to say
in Poker Face is everybody else. I liked it, but I didn't love it, like freak out about it. I found some of the situations that Natasha Lyonne gets herself into, and I know it's a television show.
It's a whodunit.
I think it's better if you're watching it week to week, and I think I watch like three or four in a row. And when you do it that way, it kind of ruins it for me. Anyway, finish your baseball point. Yeah.
All I was going to say is that with us being the light side or whatever, secretly,
sounds
though,
kind of racist.
Easy Michael Malone. I'm the Ted Danson, though. It's like, you think I'm the nice guy, the head of the good place, but underneath,
all right.
Like, you know what I'm going to say when the mic's off.
Yeah, that was a really roundabout way for us to get there. We took a lot of stops there in that roundabout. We caused a couple of accidents. All right. Let's take a quick break. That seems like a good thing to do. And then we'll come back and we'll hit on a bunch of the Raptor stuff. Last night, Fred VanVleet was brilliant. Kind of papering over, though, that this Raptors team that everybody seems to like we'll do a over-under for the people to think about. What is the Raptors' offensive rating since the All-Star break? Over or under? Let's say middle of the pack in the NBA. Let's be generous. Let's take a quick break and let's discuss that next.
Sportsnet 590.
All right. Blake Murphy didn't leave. I got a best bet coming soon. How excited are you for the tournament, by the way? I feel like this is the year where I've watched the least amount of college basketball since I was genuinely a child. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's just me doing Leafs talk.
It's hard to find the time. And World Baseball Classic this year, too, is like that ate up some conference tournament time. Yeah. I will say, I got my Shulman fix in the last couple weeks, him doing all the ACC action in the lead up. And now he's back down in Dunedin. But boy, if there's anyone who could have over the last couple weeks helped put the nail in the North Carolina coffin, Shulman just perfectly obviously he's a professional. I would bet if we gave him the J.D. Bunkus truth serum, he was kind of enjoying UNC going out that way.
I'll just say this about UNC is I always enjoy when they suck, because I live in Canada where all the UNC fans are phonies.
Yeah, they're the Yankee fans and Patriot fans.
And so when they suffer, I enjoy it, even if I think their suffering is really nothing. Anyways, the Raptors.
I had a question for you.
Yeah.
What did you think? Do you like UNC saying no to the NIT?
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah. Preseason number one in the whole country.
I just think it's like beneath them. And I like that they would hold themselves to that standard and say, we're not going there. And I think that's fine. Do you have a problem with it?
No, I think it's fine. I kind of think you should have to do it. I know it's an invite. It's the National Invitational Tournament.
I was going to say, it's in the name.
But, and if you force teams to go, like anyone who is draft relevant at all would be
exactly.
like, okay, I'm shutting it down. Scoot Henderson's already shut it down, even though our Ignite are in a playoff push. So,
wow.
Yeah.
He would do that to the Ignite?
I know. Where's the loyalty? He's the longest tenured Ignite player of all time with 2 years.
That's nuts.
Poor John Jenkins and Pooh Jeter.
I know. God, those guys, your favorite players. This is devastating stuff for you. Okay, so I gave the over-under for the Raptors offensive rating since, I said the All-Star break.
Everyone took the under.
Yeah. It is a hard under, even with yesterday's performance where Fred VanVleet was... That's about as hot as Fred, even playoff Fred. I went, did he have another child? Is this the series against
the Warriors? Well, he did a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, I guess. But it just all of a sudden is working out for him, because when he hit that one pull-up, I was laughing. I went, are you kidding me, man? You're just this is what, and Alvin's losing his mind in the broadcast going, so this is what it's like to be hot. I was like, don't pretend like you've never been hot in a basketball game, Alvin. This is offensive to those of us who suck at basketball and think that we're good. But
and Fred had the mid-range going, and I thought, you know, the best thing was he was getting to the glass.
Exactly. No, it was his best game of the year. Like, no question about it. And he was playing good defensively. He has the one pickpocket moment where Denver looks like they're starting to push and move the game in their directions, take the momentum. He steals it from Bruce Brown. Fred was brilliant last night. It was a really, really good game.
Bruce Brown, your guy.
Oh, man. I don't think I've seen one guy be as bad as Bruce Brown in as many minutes as he's played against the Raptors this year than him. Like, go look at his box scores. And especially the first game against them, he missed. I think he started like 1 of 8, 1 of 9, and was horrible defensively, made just brain fart decisions. He was terrible. And we used to like him on the Nets. I don't know what the hell happened. But the Raptors, since the All-Star break, 10 games where they're 5-5, their offensive rating is 25th in the NBA. So that's with yesterday's game, where they were really nice at home. I don't know what excuses you want to put up here, because since the All-Star break, they have played a lot of really bad teams and a lot of bad defensive teams. And so this is my question for you, dude, because a lot is being made lately about the starters and how that unit looks great and how they're outscoring teams, and it's just the bench, and it's the bench, the bench. But one of the feelings I've been having watching these guys, and this has been a wild thing, is, okay, the Raps starting five can look very good together. There's clearly a lot of talent within that group. It's undeniable, right? And I think that's actually what led Masai Ujiri to make the mistake of not taking a step backwards at the deadline, is he looks at his players in a vacuum and says, why isn't this working? I have Pascal Siakam, who is a borderline all-NBA talent. I'm bringing in Jakob Poeltl now, who we've all seen how good he can be and what presence he can be at the rim, what a great finisher he is around the basket, good role man, all of these different things. OG Anunoby, someone who, since the injury, is now shooting over 40% from three. He's just been lights out.
On volume.
Right, on a ton of shots. Fred VanVleet, who can go out and do something like that last night. And then the guy who was the rookie of the year last year, who can put up 30 against the Los Angeles Lakers.
And was, I thought, excellent last night.
Exactly.
One of the better two-way games he's played.
And he's looking at it and going, why would I give up on any of these guys when they're all really good and I get back unknown quantities? Or what's the word I'm searching for here? I'm getting back unknowns.
Yeah.
For these guys, doesn't make any sense. But even last night, Fred is playing brilliantly, and yeah, Scotty was okay, and OG hit a lot of good shots, but it just genuinely does feel like one or two guys in that unit has a good game individually, but that the pieces don't really fit together all that well. And it's why Jakob Poeltl has actually been such a breath of fresh air, because he's played so well in the role game with Fred VanVleet since he's been interjected into this team. But then you look at what's happened to Siakam since, and he's been basically his worst self since these trades have been made. And I guess, what is your theory as to why this offense just does not seem to click, even though they can showcase it at times, that it's just, yeah, man, they're among genuinely the worst teams in the NBA when it comes to offensive. Like, they're there with the Detroit Pistons, the Charlotte Hornets, the San Antonio Spurs, the Brooklyn Nets, who have traded, well, actually, they have Mikal Bridges, who's one of the best players in the NBA. But outside of that, it's like, that's the company that they're keeping right now.
And it gets worse if you look at late game scenarios, right? We went through this after the last Denver game where, yes, there was the refereeing of it all and the Scotty Barnes ejection, and there was the Fred VanVleet stuff the game after. But you dive into the crunch time numbers, and this isn't an NBA set. This is like a different one based on win probability. But in high leverage situations this year, the Raptors score more than only San Antonio and Houston. Two teams that are trying their absolute best to not score in those situations.
Yeah.
So I think this is kind of just a magnification of an half-court offensive issue that's existed for a while. And I think part of why it feels strange right now, even though maybe it shouldn't, is that this is like what they've looked like the last little bit in going 5-5 is actually what we expected coming into the year, which is be a top 10 defense, force a ton of turnovers and be unbelievable in transition, and just get enough in the half court offense. That's what we thought this team was going to look like coming in this year. And then they overperformed offensively, underperformed defensively. And then like week to week, it's like, what do you even expect? Yeah. Now you think that Jakob Poeltl will have resolved some of that. You and I have talked that even though we don't agree with the logic behind that direction at the deadline,
he's a good player.
And he fits in really, really well. Like again, that starting five.
Turns out having a center in the NBA still matters.
Yeah. And turns out for a guy like Fred VanVleet, having a pick and roll partner, someone who sets actual screens and isn't Precious Achiuwa like bumping into you right after he sets the
screen.
Buddy,
if I'm Fred and his contract negotiation with the Raptors, and if they're pulling up the season long numbers, I'm not even using those.
No, you take out the Precious minutes and focus on the Poeltl minutes?
Well, if I'm him and I'm negotiating, I'm saying, You gave me no fit stylistically. You told me to play off the ball. I did that for you, and I told you I didn't feel comfortable doing it, but I bought in and did it. So you had me playing a role I didn't want to play to try to fit other guys better. And then you finally go out and get a center, and I look like a good point guard again. What do you think is the his assists per game are up to like 10 since they got Poeltl. He's been a completely different playmaker. I've talked to Blake about this before because Blake's a huge Fred VanVleet guy, and I was very much in the camp of they should be moving him at the deadline, not for the prices that ended up happening. I still think that the Clippers were nuts to not try to include an extra first-round pick to acquire him.
No, it's going
to
go down as the Talen Horton-Tucker thing, right?
Yeah, it's going to be really bad. But I will say that, having a big man for Fred has really changed my opinion on him as a playmaker. I thought he was too selfish to do it. He was taking too many opportunities of his own to try to go to the rim where he's not overly effective, but he's been great since then anyway.
And with Poeltl as the role man, not only is he getting better screens for separation to get to the rim, but it's kind of I always think back to the DeMar JV pick and roll pairing where DeMar would take some shots in those scenarios that he shouldn't, but JV was such a good offensive rebounder and they knew each other so well that it was like, okay, well, worst case scenario, it's a Kobe assist. I think Fred and Jakob could eventually figure that out.
I love that. That is the ultimate propaganda, is that labeling of he takes a bad shot and someone gets the rebound because there's multiple guys covering him. And so you get the Kobe assist. Yeah, that's a nice one. Anyways.
Whatever. We need to classify in the NHL too. Like if you get an assist and it's just a rebound, I don't know how much I believe. Sure, Morgan Riley misses the net a lot on the power play to set up, scrambles around the net. I don't know if you're hitting it into the goalie intentionally. Anyway.
So why don't they fit?
So, and I think a big part of this, and I don't mean to hang it on him, but the person who has had to adjust what they're doing the most with this new offensive dynamic is Pascal Siakam, and it's not working particularly well for him yet. He has the ball in his hands a little bit less. There's a little less space in the paint for good reasons. It's because you have someone who's actually a threat on the roll and a threat around the rim. But I haven't updated these stats for the last couple games, but I did a TV hit a week ago maybe, and Siakam's attempts at the rim when he shares the floor with Fred and Jakob were completely in the tank. It had been like eight attempts at the rim in like 150 minutes or something like that. And that was, I mean, I could find the updated numbers at the break or whatever, basically he can't get to the rim and can't get to the free throw line in this dynamic, whether it's because the ball's in Fred's hands more because that pick and roll pairing is so effective or there's more traffic inside. But I think you're seeing that offensively with that starting five, everything's kind of working. I think OG's shooting improvement has a lot to do with the wrist, but it also has something to do with him and Gary Trent, even though it's great to have shooters in either corner. He had to split his touches, and sometimes Gary Trent would gum up at the offense in a way. Like if Gary Trent does his little tiptoe dance to get into one of his step back jumpers, which is an awesome, awesome weapon to have if you're a key piece of a bench unit. Like those are the possessions where OG's just standing there doing nothing. And I think it was the last Denver game where he just basically ran corner to corner most of the time. So there are still adjustments happening there. I think this 5-man unit is fine. They're plus 57 in 150 minutes together. That's bonkers. The problem is that anytime you take even one of them off the court, Gary Trent Jr. has, for whatever reason, not really fit in with the starting five the way that he did for months prior. Precious Achiuwa looks lost.
I think he's broken.
I don't really know how to explain it.
I can explain it. He wasn't very good, and then now he's just worse.
Yeah, but even the defense has slid, which shouldn't be the case in those scenarios, right?
He got extremely overhyped by the fan base. He is the classic example of what the Leaf fans used to do in this city with middle-tier guys, and now Raptors fans have adopted that with some of their own. And I have been victim of this too, because even when Malachi Flynn would put two or three decent games together, I'd go, I believe again.
Yeah.
The Tacoma kid, he's here.
You've got a little bit of geographical bias, whatever, at least with Malachi Flynn.
But I've always liked Malachi. Yeah. I liked Malachi in college. I liked the pick.
Still think if I'm another team in the NBA, he's a guy that I'm doing the redraft gamble on. Let's see what he looks like.
His ceiling is a decent bench scorer guy. Then his confidence on this Raptors team, though, I think if you were going to do the criticism of their development and take a shot at the coach, he's definitely the poster boy for that. Where you go, he takes one bad shot or makes one bad play, and you staple him to the bench for three games and don't give him another opportunity.
So here is where the issue really lies. I think there is some adjustments still going on with the starting five, but a lot of this falls on the transitional units with a couple starters, couple bench. I don't think Nick Nurse has had the best run of games in terms of figuring out what the best combinations off the bench are. I think it's fairly clear. You have one of Scotty or Pascal, you have one of OG or Fred, you have Gary, and then you figure out what two other guys work in what lineup. And if, as long as you have those, you pull one from this bucket, one from this bucket, and Trent, usually the fourth piece is going to be Boucher. He's been pretty consistent off the bench. And then
feels like he hasn't been the same guy since Pirtle either.
He's just not playing a lot of minutes, which is odd. Him and Pirtle have a bit of a chemistry.
Yeah.
We'll see. And
so funny though, too, because whenever he catches the ball behind the 3-point line and he's getting ready to just pull. He didn't shoot one. I can't remember if it was yesterday or the Lakers game, where he got one and he was maybe a foot behind the 3-point line. I thought he was going to do the trebuchet and he didn't do it. And I went, wow, that's real growth. Good for you, because that was a horrible shot you were about to take.
So this is the best. And there are a ton of stats out there right now. And I've tweeted some of them of this is what the starter's performance has been. And this is how much you're playing together. And this is every other lineup. What I think the best way to contextualize it, now that we have 10 games, the seven most heavily used lineups that aren't the starting five since the All-Star break, all negative. They don't have a single bench unit that they're going to regularly that is playing opponents even neutral.
I got to tell you, though, I don't put that all on just the players that are coming off the bench.
No, I think Nurse is maybe not putting them in the best positions to succeed. No. I thought the first half rotations last night were good, but also there's an adjustment.
This is from looking at Siakam, and you're saying you don't want to lay it all at his feet, and I'm saying...
I want to lay some of it at his feet.
I'm saying I'm laying more than you, because if you are the team's quote-unquote best player... It's not like they're just playing him with Jakob Poeltl. And I feel like that has been almost the way this narrative has been pushed, is that, hey, Siakam can't get his because he's having a tough time adjusting to this space where Jakob Poeltl is now occupying it. And you go, okay, that's fair for some of the minutes. Except for then you remember last night, 12 points. He's had, I want to say here, what, one 20-point game in his last eight?
Mm-hmm. He is just... again, you can go into the numbers with getting to the rim and the free throw.
Can you carry a unit that has one guy that's coming off of the bench? Even if Precious Achiuwa is playing poorly, can you find some offense? So, when I look at this offensive rating, okay, and this is why I'm laying it more at Siakam's feet. If you're 25th in the NBA in offensive rating since the trade deadline, and you are having your bench units crater, I need that to be put on the plate of my team's best player. And that's supposed to be Pascal Siakam. What other team would we be doing this for? Go around the NBA, pick out the team's best player. If they plummet down to 25th in the NBA in offensive rating and their best player is only giving you, what is it at this point? 16 a night, 15 a night since the All-Star break? It's been tough. Last night, again, 12 points and awful shooting and bad decision-making again, where he looks just not explosive.
And the defense has really slid too.
Yes.
And I know Pascal's always been, week to week a bit trick or treat on defense. Yeah. Some weeks he looks like all NBA defense, and some weeks he doesn't look like that guy. But this is two Denver games in short order where Michael Porter Jr. Not only swallowed him up, but just catching the inattention. If you are not part of the Jokic pick and roll defense, you have to be so locked into your guy. And Michael Porter Jr. had 10 points in the first. I haven't looked up the stats this morning, but the first meeting had 10 points off of cuts and backdoor screens and stuff
that. This is what I'm trying to say here with this is I think the Raptors with Masai Ujiri at the deadline, a couple of things happened. One is that he didn't get met with some of the prices that he wanted to. That's pretty clear. But two is that he is overvaluing some of his players. That those two things in combination had led to a Raptors deadline that shocked genuinely every single person in the NBA, because they went, what the hell is happening here? How did this go down this way? I think it would be a mistake to evaluate what's happening with the Raptors right now and lay it purely at the feet of, well, they just don't really have any bench players. Because frankly, Precious Achiuwa is playing poorly. Gary Trent has had some really down games coming off the bench. But I think we all agree that if Gary Trent is coming off of your bench, that's a pretty decent piece. And he can be that type of trick-or-treat kind of player. That you do have Chris Boucher. There is talent off of this bench. It's not it's not completely bereft of that. What they need is for their best player to play better and to feel like he fits with the group. And this has been my number one issue with the Raptors, and it's why I started with it, is why don't these guys fit together? It just seems to me that there's not a lot of nights, and I should have maybe looked through this, but where all these guys play together, where it feels like they're playing together with one another or that they're helping each other look better in a game. Scottie Barnes will have the odd night where his playmaking shows up and you go, man, he's making his teammates better. OG will have nights where he's making beautiful cuts and just finding open spaces on the floor, and I go, that guy's making his teammates better. Fred VanVleet with Jakob Poeltl has done much better in that pick and roll, and I go, these two guys are making each other better. Right now, Siakam feels like the odd man out who's boxed out, and this is someone who we've praised for being a good playmaker, and I'm just not seeing any type of adjustment from him. And so to put it off as he's tired, fine, okay, that can be part of a theory. He's played the most minutes in the NBA. I can accept that. I continue to look at this and say they're going to have to make a decision on a major player going into this offseason and what they're going to do. And maybe the lesson that they learn from this, there's still time. We'll see what ends up happening. It's very, very counterintuitive. But maybe the best move for these guys is to actually end up saying, you know what? The team is not going to work if it's Pascal Siakam's team, and he might actually be the guy that you put on the trade block during the offseason and just see what the rest of the NBA is willing to offer you.
Yeah, I mean, you do that real quietly because he's going to have to be back. I think in a lot of scenarios, you're not going to, like, we know how this team values their guys, and I don't know that.
I just know they're not going in luxury talks with these guys, and I don't think they
shouldn't. Like, you go to.
But it would be bad business practice for them to even let Gary Trent Jr. walk for absolutely nothing after you lose in what, round one of the playoffs at best this year is pretty much the ceiling of this team.
And the hard part with Siakam and those bench units is I just brought the numbers up, and on the season, like, this is a relatively new thing for him. Earlier in the year, he was running bench units really capably, and you, in times when he was the only starter or one of two starters on the floor, he had like a 30% usage and almost 60% true shooting. Like, that's exactly what you want your star player to put up when he's running bench units. I am at a loss for why it has collapsed lately. It's something I maybe got to dig a little bit more into the film on, but I think there's, like, I don't really subscribe to the, and I know Michael Grange had a great piece on this at sportsnet.ca yesterday about
he's tired.
No, it was that a little bit, but we're back to some of the, like, he has to remind himself that basketball is where he gets his joy and stuff like that.
I just don't love that.
It's come up a little too much. I think everyone has stretches.
He's very sheltered when it comes to criticism.
Yeah, and, like, everyone has bad stretches.
Sure.
But this is, like, pretty outlier for him. Even as a guy who's been, like, up and down and had some criticism for, you know, having weeks or playoff series where he's not there or struggling late in games, like, this last 8, 9, even 10 games has been pretty uncharacteristic for him. And normally what you see since Siakam established himself as an all-NBA guy, why I think he gets sheltered from criticism a little bit is a lot of times what you've seen when the scoring dries up, the playmaking numbers go up, the defense comes up. We haven't really seen that, in part because with the playmaking, other things are working in the offense, and working is a word that's a low bar for this team.
Sure.
But things are working for the starting group run differently. I don't have a good explanation for why the defense has slid and why suddenly a lineup with him and Boucher and Trent and one of the other starters that worked all year now isn't working. Like, those pieces haven't changed.
I want to make it clear, too, I'm not advocating right now for the Seattle trade.
No, I got you.
I'm saying that it should at least be on the table, and if it continues this way, that to me is going to be a mounting, growing discussion.
Here's the truth. If you're a play-in team, everything should be on the table.
That's what
everything
I'm saying.
Should be getting discussed. Like short of you miss the play-in and those long-shot lottery odds land you Wemby or Scoot, in which case you can justify running it back because you're dropping a very, very good talent into a play-in or first-round team environment. Everything needs to be on the table, because the hard part right now is even though they have 6 or 7 good pieces that any team would want to have and you'd want on your roster sheet as you're building, they're still not very good.
Yeah, that's it. They're just not a good basketball team. And I tweeted this the other night. They can trick you for a quarter or two. Mm-hmm. They can look really good.
Look at the first quarter last night.
Exactly. They can look really good. And even for me, who's watched them all year long and who's seen this before, will sit there during quarters like that yesterday and go, man, maybe this team could make some noise. Like, I'm watching OG fly around, catching offensive rebounds and just flushing them. I saw that Barnes play in the first, and you're going, damn, this is nice. Pirtle's getting his, oh, by the way, my Botano best bet yesterday missed by a point. Jakob Poeltl, 8 points in the first quarter.
Ooh.
And then completely dry the rest of the game. That hurt. That hurt. That one was...
Well, he
that,
ended up with 10, right?
No, he ended up with 12.
Okay. He
did 13.
Ah.
Yeah, and actually, I know sorry, he had I missed the double by two.
At one point, he had 10-10-5. No. I was like, oh, that's a nice round
number. I needed over 13.5 at plus 106,
okay.
And I thought that was great based on his game versus Denver, and he scored the 8 quick, and I went, this was the smartest. I'm the smartest human being who ever lived. Yeah. Of course, this is going to work out
well,
for me.
Well, that was like your one the other week with OG, where he had all the points immediately,
yeah.
And then was 1 point shy until
but
like the fourth quarter. He did
but
get it.
But then he got
yes.
it, right?
He so. Was, that was either going to be JD has come around on OG, or we can never talk about OG on the JD Bunkus podcast.
Yeah.
Again.
That's the thing. OG has looked so great as of late that
I have a piece coming on him for Sportsnet later this week. By the way,
he's. I don't want to be too much of a prisoner of the moment. I want to try to remember all the things that the Raptors have stacked together. I do understand that Siakam is still at his best, this team's best player. It's just that when we're talking about timelines and we're talking about ways forward for this team, I guess I never really had him as an on the table guy. It was always a conversation between, hey, are you going to move Gary Trent Jr. at the deadline? I thought that was a lock. They didn't end up doing it. Grange was right. Only guy that predicted that. Are they going to move Fred VanVleet? It seems like they tried. It couldn't get it done. The price wasn't there. Now it feels like almost a near certainty that they will make a pretty aggressive push to keep him as a part of the Toronto Raptors organization.
And unless someone OG. Just blows you away with a
right.
sign and trade. But like, this is, again, and, back to what
that?
You said earlier
no.
about like, now you have Poeltl in there, like, did you really trade assets for Poeltl and then you're going to trade away the guy who's good at utilizing Poeltl?
Exactly. And so it doesn't really make any sense. It feels like they're going to have to spend a ton of cash on Poeltl and VanVleet, who have only increased their values since the deadline. And yeah, at one point I thought you could not pay Fred VanVleet, but what makes more sense? Letting him walk to a different team for nothing? Like, they're just in a tough spot
and
with
this, it. And this is the bird rights trap,
yeah.
right? It's like, one, you're in this situation and you don't have a path to cap space even if the guy leaves.
Yeah.
You lose a lot of leverage in negotiations and Clutch is probably going to be sitting there saying, okay, but if he leaves,
yep.
you have this exact team but without Fred and okay, you can use your mid-level exception and get another Otto Porter or Jared Sollinger or Stanley Johnson.
Yeah, and with Siakam, just he'll be turning 29 years old. So if we're talking about timelines and fit and different conversations that this team might have. If you're trying to sell OG Anunoby on saying, hey, we want you to stay here. We want to re-sign you. If I'm him, I'm going, well, what's going to change for me? I clearly want more, you know, like I want to be able to showcase what I did against the Lakers more often
Even
than
last
I do
night.
With this team, right?
Little pick and roll
for sure.
operating. Gave
How
it,
do you
gave it to Jamal Murray a couple times. Not that Jamal Murray is the most locked in of defenders.
Yeah.
But.
It to me, it felt like the Raptors were picking from three guys that they were going to move off of. Trent, being the most obvious,
OG or Fred.
And to me, I actually think that conversation should also extend to the 29-year-old guy who has been deemed the face of the franchise. And you go, all right, we made a lot of excuses. You turned it on last year in the Sixer series, but you also put the Raptors in a hole. Like, yeah, you played brilliantly after the first couple of games, but you were also so dreadful in the first few that it didn't really work out. Okay, this team is horrible in crunch time, like you mentioned. Last 5 minutes of a game in clutch situations, Siakam has been bad. Like, it just has not worked. And so if he's going to be the head of your snake on this team, like, when is that going to change? When is that going to be something that actually you're able to roll over and hand the reins to Barnes, if that's going to be the case, or give it to someone else? I don't know how that transition works for you. The only difficulty is, I was trying to think about landing spots for Siakam, just last night, looking at some of the standings, thinking about a little bit of salary matching, but not even using that too much, like not even trying to make it realistic in terms of what would be coming back. Just thinking about what team would push a ton of chips into the middle for Pascal Siakam. And I kind of drew a bit of a blank, man. Like, I looking around the league, there's not a clear and obvious three teams that would break the bank to acquire him.
Things change quickly in the offseason, though.
Okay.
Like, teams that are fringy right now and wouldn't make a lot of sense if they like this won't. This is a poor example just because of the Sam Presti of it all. But the Thunder on paper, absolutely the type of team that could come out of nowhere and this offseason decide, no, we were close this year and we were trying not to be.
Well, sir, I did that for the trade machine for you
yes.
and your column. So, yes.
Yes. They're,
and you're like these guys, when they pitch my ideas for guests
ideas back
to me,
to you? Yeah.
I'll be like, hey, guys, here's my idea for guests. And then all
of
a sudden on Wednesday, yeah, they'll be like, oh, GD, what were you thinking about having a Blake on a Wednesday? I was like, yeah, thanks, guys. I appreciate that. Think about your own stuff. But yeah, so you're right.
Thunder,
that could happen.
The Thunder are a poor example because I don't think they will do it. But there are going to be teams like that. The Pelicans are super interesting because they still have some young players and extra picks.
But you're going to put him Grizzlies. With Zion and Brandon Ingram.
Is Zion ever going to play?
I don't know, but I'm just saying that one to me doesn't make sense.
The Grizzlies who need more offensive punch.
But where are they doing that?
Portland, who traded away, they did their let's focus on next year and be patient, Dame, and traded away Josh Hart for picks.
So the teams that I put together, Portland.
Yeah.
Still Indiana.
Yeah.
Where you would go if the Pacers want to take that next step and move some pieces in the middle and they actually feel like, all right.
He'd be a good fit with Miles Turner.
That's
too.
What I'm saying. You've got Miles Turner, Halliburton, and Siakam. But then I thought about that and I went, where is that getting you? And now you're in the same quandary the Raptors are in where you go, is Halliburton the closer or is Siakam?
I think having multiple options as the closer is better, but also like, I hate to say it because there are small samples and stuff like that, but like Siakam does not have a great track record in those scenarios. So I don't know that he could have, like, there might be a situation of, well, pitch better, right? Like, and Halliburton is the face of that franchise now.
Hold on.
Here's the other thing about Siakam, though.
Wait. Oh, yeah. You wanted me to finish my list of places that could do it? Because I'm building up to the most interesting one.
Okay. So Portland, Indiana.
Yeah. Those are the ones where I go, maybe, but I don't see it. I just don't think that either of those teams are going to try to rush whatever it is they're doing. And I also don't think if you're Damian Lillard and you get Pascal Siakam, you're all of a sudden thinking, we're going to win now.
Like, I mean, KD wanted him.
Yeah. No, I'm sure he, of course he did. But that was KD. This is Damian Lillard in his 30s, who's already doing things like a full campaign on, it doesn't matter if I don't win a championship. I'm going, all right.
Hey, Chris Haynes, can you tweet out that I didn't leave Portland? And Chris Haynes probably responds like, man, it's the middle of August. I'm on vacation. What are you talking about? He's like, I didn't leave Portland.
Yeah, why does everybody care about who wins the championship all of a sudden? It was Damian Lillard's take yesterday. I actually liked when he crapped on young people. I went, they are entitled. But then when he tried to do the whole, enjoy the process, enjoy the journey, I went, how about you guys play the regular season games and we'll care about
Sisyphus.
That too.
Albert Camus.
Those were two teams that I had written down. I obviously pitched to you the Thunder and the case for that in the all your trades are bad column. But the most interesting one to me is apparently there's a lot of James Harden's going to go back to Houston buzz. And I wonder if the Raptors could find a way with the Sixers. It would be tough. But if they could do something where Toronto... Oh,
you're going Sixers. I thought you were going Rockets and like Harden tries to lure him as a...
I mean, actually, now that kind of works too, except for I thought, that he goes and joins his buddy Joel Embiid and they have the Cameroon Canucks.
Do you really think, like, could Masai bring himself to give another team?
No, the biggest hole in this argument is that Daryl Morey and Masai Ujiri already tried to negotiate on what should have been the world's most obvious deal, and they couldn't come to anything reasonable. So it's hard to imagine trading a cornerstone piece like Siakam to there, and especially in conference, right?
Teams don't really have picks either.
That's the one where it's like, if you could predict a fit for Siakam where you could just have a clear... Man, there's a clear number one here, and they're trying to win, and there's a fit, and a personality match. It is the Sixers. I just wonder maybe if Joel Embiid asks for a trade somewhere, and then Siakam ends up going to that spot too. Like, they flame out, Harden leaves, Embiid goes to New York, and then all of a sudden he says, hey, also, I need you to trade somebody for Siakam.
See, that's one scenario. I have also always thought since, the cry at Scotiabank Arena that...
The cry.
The Raptors were not always keeping their flexibility and assets just for Giannis.
Yeah. Oh, you think that they would try to make a move for
Embiid? I think if Embiid decided he was done in Philly, Toronto would be very high on his list.
Yeah. That's why they traded for Jakob Poeltl. They're like, yo, this is one for one.
Yeah, but you could turn around and flip Jakob Poeltl. Yeah. The other thing is, if Philly does go after, if you could get Tyrese Maxey back.
Yeah. Well, that's clearly the main piece that would have to come back your way. All right. It's time for Best Bets, brought to you by Betano, the 2022 Global Sports Betting Operator of the Year. Tons and tons and tons. I mentioned I'm not really there yet with my college knowledge. Today is a bone up on my numbers day, and I will be starting today. I'll be Ken Palman today, and I'll be putting in some bets for round one. I'm gonna have my friend Daniele help me get a little bit of insight, even though, again, he's always led me astray when it comes to these bets, but I'll still allow him to infiltrate. So I've got a couple of just quick things to mention. This feels like a weird night for the Leafs playing the Avs. I'm going to leave it alone. The Avs, their last seven games, though, I just wanted to reference this. They haven't beaten anybody good. They beat Montreal, they beat Arizona, they beat San Jose. Their losses are to the Kings, Kraken, Devils, and Stars. I just thought that was worth noting tonight. Just a little note for any Leaf fans. Leafs beat the brakes off them last time they played. Still, there's a weirdness to this one that I'm going to avoid it. I'm going to allow Blake Murphy to pick one of my two bets that I've barely locked in. I like two bets in the NBA tonight. Number one, the Bulls and Kings since the All-Star break both have the highest percentage from the field in the NBA, and they're combining both for 40% from three. Sacramento, bottom five defensive rating on the year. I kind of like this one to go over. Used to be an old saying, hey, pick the highest total and go over. It's 237.5, which is an astronomically high number, obviously. But these are two red-hot teams with some suspicious defenses, and I like both teams to be able to score. Or the Los Angeles Lakers are going to be without Anthony Davis and LeBron James tonight, but they are only 2.5-point favorites on Betano against the Houston freaking Rockets. And I just feel like the Lakers depth guys have a little bit of pride that they're not going to lose this game, right? So, Blake, which one of these two do you like better? Because I'm locking in one of these two.
Yeah, I like them both. I like the Lakers one a little better because I think you're right. The last time we saw this group without Anthony Davis or LeBron, they beat a Thunder team that's much better than this Rockets team. Now, that Thunder team, if I'm remembering right, didn't have Shea that game, but the Rockets don't have anybody. They're a little league team. They are the Rio Grande Valley Vipers of the G League, basically. And you saw, I mean, guys, the pieces that they added are mostly role player types, but Dennis Schroeder can like step up and
he can
carry Rozier his way to 20, 25 points. It's my favorite thing from the last FIBA World Cup where he was playing for Germany and the coach like called him out publicly and was like, we need you to play like a more team-oriented game. And he said, basically, you need me more than I need the World Cup. I'm going to play a Dennis Schroeder game. That's what he does. But I think against a team like Houston that can't defend and doesn't really want to do anything, I like the Lakers.
So then I'm going to do that. I'm going to say Lakers minus 2.5 tonight at the Houston Rockets. D'Angelo Russell.
They also set that record last night, franchise record for most threes.
Oh, I know. That's the thing. I got to believe that the Lakers can get this done. You're still in a playoff push. Seeding still matters for you.
Also, potentially no Alperen Şengün for the Rockets, who is like their main piece.
He's
now
at least hurt. he's at least not 100%. By the way, as I always like to mention, Betano, 248 offerings tonight on the Leafs game. So, yeah, you can't find one bet out of 248. I know, there's an insane amount of offerings.
Let me know later, by the way, when you do your Ken Pom and your Bart Torvik and stuff like that, who you come away with as your, like, analytic favorite. I wonder if we end up with a similar, like, Elite Eight.
Yeah,
if that's the way you're going at
it. Here's the thing about me and my brackets every year. So I'm a pretty chalky dude. It's pretty lame. But, yeah, I'm a chalk king.
It depends on the format. This is the biggest piece of advice for anyone doing brackets.
This year's not the chalkier, though.
No, I just mean know your format.
Yeah.
Because some formats are, like, incentivize you to do chalk. Some formats incentivize you to take Drake to make the Elite Eight. Because if you hit one double-digit seed going far, you're in the money.
100%. You better be in the fan one, by the way.
I'm in there. The one Lance organizes? Yes, already 100%. Filled out the bracket.
Oh, what a guy. That was Best Bets brought to you by Betano Sportsbook. The game starts now. Quick break. Then, Keith Law, baseball writer and author of Inside the Game on all the Jays prospects and kind of where they're at after the spring. And then my guy, Ariel Helwani. Next.
Here's how to...
All right, one of the best. Keith Law, baseball writer for The Athletic, author of The Inside Game. Again, one of the absolute best to pick the brains on when it comes to prospects. Good morning, Keith. Thanks for doing this, man.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for having me.
So we got to start with the talk of the town, which is Ricky Tiedemann. And he just got shut down. He's got a bit of shoulder inflammation. Not what you want to hear with the young fireballer, but how high are you on this guy? Like, are you in on the big hype train that's happening up north here?
Probably not. I think I'm more of a realist. Obviously, I'm not a fan, so I don't have the sort of emotional investment as well. But I had concerns about him staying healthy even based on last year, right? He missed a couple starts in July, and then when they brought him back at the end of the season, they were limiting him to just three innings every outing, which they said was workload management, but it was pretty easy to see. I went and saw him in one of those outings, too. He didn't have 100% of his stuff, too, and he's definitely dealing with something that was reducing his velocity at that point. So, yeah, I'm not loving hearing that he's got some shoulder inflammation. I think the upside is huge. I mean, I think you can look at him and say you got a number one, number two starter there if he holds up. But now we've got a fair bit of evidence from the last, I'd say, 12 months or so that that's at least not a given, that there is at least some reason to think maybe he doesn't hold up under a typical starter's workload.
Yeah, and that's always usually the harder one to project. Hey, if a guy stays healthy. But is that the number one concern for you with him? Is just that, the health?
Yeah, and the delivery itself is not great, not super easy. And I did wonder about, is that going to allow him to get to real fastball command? Is he going to have some issues locating to his glove side, given where his arm, you know, where his arm slot is and where he finishes in his delivery? But honestly, that stuff was, for me, was all secondary. It was more, hey, this guy's only thrown this hard for about 15 months or so. Let's see if he's able to hold up and carry through for a full season's workload. And I'm worried, even if he does recover from this bout of shoulder inflammation, what's the year going to look like and how much is he really going to be able to pitch?
Yeah, I've heard this from some people too, which is that, yeah, that delivery has worked for certain guys in the bigs. Mm-hmm. There have been some dudes that have made it work, but yeah, more often than not, it comes to bite you in the ass at some point. It has derailed a lot of different guys' careers. So he's the clear crown jewel of their organization, though. Like, he's the guy that they wouldn't move a year ago. He's the guy that they're still hoping is going to have some impact for them, maybe even as early as this season, 20 years old, all this different stuff. So what do you make of the Jays farm as a whole? Because after the Gabriel Moreno trade, it felt very, very depleted to everyone. I wonder where you're at on that. Like, if they are one of the bottom groups now, or if that's overstated, like, what do you just make of the group as a whole?
I think I had them 17th in my farm system rankings, which it was basically putting them right around the median. Mm-hmm. And they're a little thin up top in terms of high impact and close to the majors guys. But I see a lot of upside at the lower levels for them, including the two high school kids they took in last year's draft, Brandon Barriera and Tucker Tolman, and a lot of the Latin American players they signed as Latin American free agents, as international free agents, who are still in A-ball. I think there's actually quite a bit of potential in that entire group. You know, we should see some of those guys take a step forward this year. I think when you've got that many guys with upside who are, you know, 17, 18, 19 years old, you can look at them as a group and say, well, obviously some of these guys are going to fall off and some, you know, but some, you hope some percentage of them do produce well enough that we can look at them and say that these guys are going to be impact prospects, you know, 2-3 years down the road.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you what the timeline is on guys like that generally for you, and you answered it, 2-3 years down the road. So, hey, Blue Jays. Sorry, what were you going to say, Keith?
I just said that's the hope, right? Yeah. That a Gabriel Martinez type, for example, is, you know, 2-3 years away from making big league impact. But that we're talking about him as a serious prospect a year from now. He was the guy I tabbed as my sleeper for the system, and I hope we have this conversation, you know, next February or so, and he's in their top 3 or 4 in the entire organization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think they're going to need to hope for something like that too. And just in terms of, yeah, their flexibility to make moves, because it seems like the Jays have spent a lot of what they're willing to do. They've got a lot of their core team. They've got a lot of guys that are coming up for big contracts. And yeah, if they're going to continue to try to build around this team through trade and not free agency, yeah, they're going to have to hit on a couple of those guys. So I talked to Kyle McDaniel a couple of months ago about Aroldis Martinez, and he had mentioned that he's the type of prospect that a lot of people are very split on, given kind of the boom or bust potential, I guess maybe a little bit similarly to Tiedemann, just not as much with injury concerns, more just, yeah, with actual ability. Where do you land with him?
I think the entire perception of Aroldis would be very different if they hadn't been so aggressive in promoting him to Double A last year. Because it's very easy, I think, for folks to either look at the stat line or for scouts who maybe are a little more performance-based. You go sit on a player for 6 games in a typical Double A series, and he had a .280 on base last year, right? You're going to see him make a lot of outs. And I think it's hard to see a guy like that. Your natural inclination is, all I saw this guy do was make a bunch of outs. it's hard to separate what you're seeing from the underlying tools. This is a guy who probably should have been in high A for at least a good chunk of last year. And then the fact that he can't do some things. He's got exceptional power. I think he's going to be a very good defensive third baseman. I actually saw him play some shortstop last year, and he was fine. I don't think he stays there, but he's better than I expected. And there's bat speed. There's a lot to like about him, and if he were at a more appropriate level for his, not just his age, but his current skill set at the plate, we'd probably be talking about him differently. But it's hard to overlook a year like that, where he did have an on-base percentage and walk rate and strikeout rate, all of which are sort of poor predictors or predictors of poor performance going forward. I still like him. I still think there's a pretty good chance they get an above-average big leaguer there, but they're going to have to change the plan for him, where they put him to start the year and what they have him work on specifically at the plate.
Well, that's especially interesting because I think a lot of people, they assume when you rush a prospect, that just means going to the major leagues. And I guess it's probably more common than that this happens with prospects at lower levels of baseball where they do end up rushing guys and that actually hampers their development.
Yes, I completely agree. It's a little bit for folks who are familiar with the idea of the Peter principle in the corporate world. You promote someone to the level of their incompetence. I wouldn't be quite that harsh with a prospect, but the idea is that you succeeded at this level, we promote you. You succeed at this level, we promote you. Oh, now you failed.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, it's like the guy's a disappointment. No, in Aurelvis's case, I mean, I did not agree with them promoting him to AA to start the year. But I also understand how they got there, too. This guy succeeded at previous levels, and we think he's an advanced player. I think they were wrong about that particular part.
Yeah.
And then we saw, and you never want to demote a guy. That's the worst part of this, is demoting a guy really feels like a failure to everyone involved. And so that is the big argument against promoting a guy too quickly, whether it's the big leagues or even just promoting him to AA.
We're literally on this show in the process of promoting a guy named Peter, and you have just changed everything here. Like the poor kid behind the glass, he's the one who called you. He's the one who texted you. So yeah, I don't know, Pete.
Sorry, Peter.
That's tough. That's a tough look for you today. All right. So Addison Barger, the name started to pop up because of you. Like, you were the first person that kind of mentioned that he could be a somebody that I had heard of. What do you think he can be for this year's baseball team?
I think he could definitely step in and be a, utility infielder / platoon guy where, maybe he doesn't have a single set position. Somebody asked me in a chat, a Q&A I did, could he replace Kevin Biggio? And that's an easy yes for me. I've never believed in Kevin Biggio's bat, and I think the last 2 years have really borne that out. I think Barger is more. He's a better hitter. He's got more power. He's better able, but I think better prepared to hit major league quality pitching. I do wonder if he's going to hit left-handers enough, and I'm not sure. He really cannot play shortstop, which I think does limit his potential as a utility guy, but if he is getting 500, 400, say, at bats and playing a lot of second, a lot of third, where I've seen him play pretty well, you could probably stick him in left or right field as needed. But that's a pretty useful player, especially since he bats left-handed. That gives him a lot more value. And I could see him doing that and being an above replacement level player for them this year, with the potential to become more down the road as maybe a full-time job opens up somewhere.
Again, he really just hit the radar for us, I think, this spring. Mm-hmm. There hadn't really been a lot of conversation about him, but I was discussing this just even earlier on my show, that if he is somebody, like if he is who, you think he could be, and then you've also got Espinal, but whatever, he's going to be in there because of his defense. They've also got Whit Merrifield they're trying to move around. They've got Kevin Biggio, and now the other guy is Otto Lopez, who hits on the other side of the plate. Like he's a right-handed hitter. He's having a moment right now for Canada baseball. He just hit a 3-run shot where we might be dangerous, Keith. Look out for us. Just saying.
Yeah.
don't let the 12-1 or whatever that was fool you. We might beat Mexico today. But do you think that it could come down to a decision between those two guys, or that, the eventuality is that somebody who does bat left, like Biggio, that just becomes less of a commodity even for him as the Bargers push him out? Like, where do you see Lopez factoring into this?
Well, I think it depends a bit on what do they need. Do they decide that they'd rather have the bat with the positional flexibility, and particularly the left-handed bat, or do they care more about defense and somebody who could potentially fill in at shortstop? I mean, this is a problem with almost every major league team running basically a short bench because they want to carry more pitchers. And I think that's ultimately the deciding factor, too, is to, if they decide they want the defense, they decide they want somebody who can fill in at shortstop, you take Lopez, who I like also, who I think is a – but he is just a utility player for me. I don't think Lopez ends up a starter at any point. Barger probably has that potential. And if they'd rather have the bat or want to look at Barger with an eye towards, hey, can this guy maybe be our regular third baseman in 2024 – that might be an argument for getting Barger on the roster. If not an opening day, maybe it's just for the bulk of the season, right? Whoever makes the opening day roster, we all tend to focus on that a lot. It's really about who gets the most playing time over the course of the year.
For sure. So trying to read between the lines on this, it seems like maybe Otto Lopez, the story around him is that he's establishing he looks like a Major League Baseball player, just not with a ton of upside. Whereas, yeah, we're not quite as sure with Barger, but the upside is far greater.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I think Barger may decide that they need his particular skill set less to start the year. Most teams want a utility infielder. If you're only carrying one extra infielder, you want a guy who can really play shortstop. And that's the one thing Barger, I've seen him at short too. I saw him in high school. He's not a shortstop. But I actually thought he was pretty good over at third base. And that might end up being what they want to do over the course of the season, is get enough looks at him at third base to decide, are they comfortable, obviously, letting go of Chapman and allowing Barger maybe to take over at third base or to be the strong side of a platoon at third base too. That is also an option, and all of which involves evaluating him for some length of time in the big leagues this year.
Keith, always appreciate you coming on. I know our audience does. I do too. Have a great day, man. Thanks for doing this.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Take care. Baseball writer for The Athletic, author for Inside the Game. The guy who let us know what the Peter Principle is. We cannot promote Pete. Pete's rise died today at the hands of Keith Law. I'm sorry, Pete. That's just, it's really tough to come back from that. We're really trying to promote Pete. We're trying to find more things for him to do around the show. And then Keith Law comes on this day and says, yeah, don't promote people to the level of incompetence. And now I'm kind of going, that is sort of where we were going with Pete. This is sort of where we were at with Pete. Now, I'm rattled.
I'm sorry, JD. I was taking notes and highlighting clips. What happened?
Yeah, exactly. That's right.
I'll stick up for Pete.
No, but that's the thing. Pete is just proven my point. He's like,
he wasn't paying attention.
Right.
Yeah, he did.
I wasn't paying attention. I got so overwhelmed by one small task that I was unable to do anything else, and I'm not sure of what happened. Okay, so a couple quick things off of that. The Tiedemann, that's now the second top-tier prospect guy who has referenced the delivery of Ricky Tiedemann being problematic. And that scares me a little bit. And now I'm taking a little bit more into the shoulder soreness and them being uber cautious, and because he's doing, I think, long toss today. So he's not in that rough a shape, but obviously the organization is taking it serious. And for, major insiders, or sorry, I guess prospect evaluators to be discussing this feels a little bit left off the table when we've been discussing him here in Toronto. Seems like something the outside guys have basically reference immediately. Two, Aurelvis Martinez, Addison Barger, kind of Otto Lopez, but yeah, I'm hoping that he's a somebody, but just being a platoon player for this team, just having somebody that could step in and give you meaningful innings. I said it before that the Matt Chapman contract is by far the most interesting for me when it comes to whatever the Blue Jays are going to be for the next couple of seasons. Because it seems pretty clear they're going to at least, well, they've already gotten something done with Bo Bichette, but a lot of us sort of assume that he's not getting that next contract with Toronto, that he's going to want to get out and that it's going to really focus on Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and then Alek Manoah. There's only going to be so much money to spread around. Are they going to be able to get it done with all three? I hope so, whatever. But are they going to spend significant cash or move extra cash on riskier free agent types? They did it with George Springer. They did it with Hyunjin Ryu. But that was when the Blue Jays were not spending any money. They gave Tanner Roark that cash because they thought, we're not going to be able to spend this in any other way. So just take this money. They went out and got free agents that they've paid for, like Kevin Gausman. That's a prime stud who is entering, a period that they felt was pretty predictable for him. Chapman, analytically, not to me in the eye test, is already showing some signs of regression, both at the plate and at third base. And if they sign him, there's a good chance that it goes a bit of the way of Josh Donaldson, where you can still point to it and go, yeah, this has been pretty good, but he's clearly not the same guy that he used to be. And if there's a drop-off in his play, what does that look like? But next year at third base, there's no immediate guy that you could sign and say, well, there's the next Matt Chapman. It would have to come through a trade. And then we're talking about, well, if it comes through a trade, who are you giving up? Because they've made it very clear they don't want to move Tiedemann. Aurelvis Martinez, teams seem to be a bit split on. He just is coming off of a bad year. Maybe he bounces back and reestablishes a bunch of his value. But as of right now, Keith just said it. They're 17th. They're in the middle of the pack. But that is boosted for him by lottery tickets. Maybe another team will want to take a couple of those lottery tickets off your hand, and that'll work for one of these trades. But if we're talking about like a known commodity at third base, I think that you should try to value it fairly similarly. If there's any term on the deal, or if it is cost controllable, like the Varsho, that it's going to take a more known piece than as an 18-year-old kid that maybe 2 years from now establishes himself. So maybe one of those lottery tickets really comes boom or bust, or booms this year, and you can figure out a way to do it. But the Barger one at third is the most interesting, because if he can actually be an impact player, if he can show some of that upside, if he can make this team this year and actually do something with it, if he's already better than Kevin Biggio, that really might make that decision a lot easier. So weirdly, his year right now, what you want to see from Addison Barger, everything is basically going to be gravy. Everything is going to be, you hope so. This would be great if it actually pans out. But I think the reality of his importance is he could be the guy that ends up stepping in, taking Matt Chapman's job, or at least makes the Blue Jays feel a little bit more comfortable, like they have some type of leverage in their negotiation with Chapman, where they don't have to go into a really, really uncomfortable salary slot, term, whatever, because they feel like they at least have an option there. It's just hard to believe that Addison Barger is going to emerge this year, a guy who, frankly, on ESPN's page doesn't have a photo, is going to...
Never a good sign.
Yeah, it's not great. Literally the only Blue Jays player remaining. Never mind. There's a guy named Mason Flaherty, who's still with the Blue Jays right now, I guess, that also does not have a pitcher. But hard to believe it, hard to project it, but going to be one of the stories of the season if he is performing well, whether or not he's going to be ready for more of a role the following season, and whether or not you can cobble together some of these platoon guys and get something halfway decent at third base so that you can spend your money elsewhere. Anyway, mm-hmm. Let's take a quick break. Slap League died. I can't believe it. It didn't survive. Who would have ever thought that Slap League was not going to be the sport of the future? There actually was a moment there where I thought, oh my God, are ratings going up for this thing? Is this actually going to work out? Slap League is dead. The Bills have lost Tremaine Edwards, so we'll check in on Ariel Helwani there. The Knicks are red hot, and we've got a huge fight this weekend between Kamaru Usman and Leon Edwards. And we'll talk to Ariel about, there's been a lot of GOAT debates going on recently with John Jones, who, for me anyways, established that he is the greatest of all time after this last fight. Personally, he's mine. I don't put the steroids in. It's kind of like the Barry Bonds thing for me, except for I don't know how much John Jones did, where I go, he might have juiced, he might have done some things, but I don't think that really impacted the fighter that we saw, the dominance of John Jones. Maybe I'm being naive with that, but that's just where I'm at. But why is it that Usman has completely fallen out of that conversation, especially when he's a huge favorite this weekend to recapture his belt against Leon Edwards, and he quote-unquote was taking his soul, as he put it, before he ended up with the unfortunate knockout. Anyways, Ariel Helwani, obviously one of the show's favorites. That's next. Quick break. We'll come back. Leave 5 stars, review, subscribe.
590, The Fan.
So before we get Ariel Helwani, and maybe I'll bring him in on this conversation when we get him. Yesterday, my favorite thing from the sporting world was not Fred VanVleet dropping, what do you have, 33?
Something like that.
Yeah. I think Fred had 33. Just lights out, red hot, carried the 36. Raptors. 36.
Wow.
Shortchanged him. Sorry, Freddie. Wasn't Fred VanVleet's brilliant game. It wasn't me losing a parlay, believing in my Orlando Magic to beat the San Antonio Spurs. Certainly was not that. It was Canada World Baseball, actually, which, again, 3 o'clock today. I'm going to be tuning in. I know Ariel watched it. It was second, the runner-up moment of the day yesterday to Otto Lopez's 3-run home run. Dan Orlovsky of ESPN, former quarterback, great analyst. Hope he does the show again sometime fairly soon. He tweeted this question. How many times do you use a towel post shower till you throw it in the laundry? I'm 30 times or so till it goes in. And no, I agree, but that air better be hot. I don't really understand that part of it.
I think that that means it better be smelly, I think. Hot?
No. I think it's like, no, Marlon Humphrey was the reason that he was tweeting. He replied to a Marlon Humphrey tweet.
Oh, I see.
Which was, yeah, I wanted to have a full body blower dry me off. Boom, no towel. And he's like, yeah. But I think what he's saying is I'm spending a lot of time in the shower. Like, so the room is going to be hot from all of the humidity. Either way, 30 times using a towel before you, this made me, I had to have an honest moment with Dan Orlovsky, all right? I think that most guys are closer to that number than they would ever admit publicly. How many times are you using a towel?
To be honest, I was kind of surprised by the reaction to Dan Orlovsky.
Because people were saying that he's disgusting. Admission. And I went, yeah. I don't think I go a month, okay? I don't think I go a month using the same towel. But I go at least 2 to 3 weeks. Like, I go at least 2 to 3 weeks. Just me using the towel, it's hanging up there on the bath. Is there anything more frustrating than when you get out of the shower and you forget that you did throw that towel in the laundry and now you got to do the naked cold walk to go where all the rest of the towels are? That's a horrific experience. Ariel Helwani, the MMA Hour, BT Sports, The Ringer, all of the different things. Good morning. Thanks for joining.
Oh, I have a lot of takes on this,
yeah,
by the way.
Yeah, I know. I wanted you to jump in on this. Yeah, so how many times do you use a towel before you throw it in the laundry hamper?
First of all, 2 to 3 weeks is psychotic behavior. No. I think that you should be canceled for that statement alone.
I knew you'd be too ashamed to tell the truth. That's okay. Continue. We don't all live in lavish, rich estates where the butler comes and collects the towels at the... Like, you're not the person to ask, right? Like, I don't have a maid. I'm not a millionaire like you. I have to be just a commoner where I have to think about things like, oh, I got a budget for stuff. But anyways, go on. Tell us about how the 1% of the 1% live.
And second of all, here's actually where it gets a little weird, and it's a bit of a point of contention with my wife and I. Uh-huh. For some reason, my entire family uses the same bathroom. Like, they all use the quote-unquote master bathroom. Like, the kids don't use their own. So they all use our bathroom, and so our bathroom is filled with towels. Oh. I don't know whose is whose. So there's a chance that I'm using my son's towel, my daughter's towel, and it's just like, it's like a complete royal rumble of towels. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, of course.
Much. I prefer, this is mine, this is yours. Why don't you guys use your own? But, you know, we like to share everything together. So it's funny that you mentioned this because I'm always, like, trying to introduce new towels early into the rotation, like less than a week after usage. Mm-hmm. And she's like, this is too much laundry. This is too... I'm like, I don't know if this is going to be for 3 weeks or 4 months. What am I supposed to do? It feels damp. I want to move on.
You know, I have some thoughts on this. Maybe what you do is you just buy a towel rack that has everybody's initial... You know, like get one of those things, like a his and hers, but also the children. And so everyone's responsibility is to hang up their towel on the correctly marked spot. So buy something, get something maybe custom made that looks really cool so that it catches the eye so that everybody's invested in it. Or you just go full, like, this is too much laundry. Too bad. So sad. I'm treating this like I'm at the gym. You get a towel hamper for that bathroom. I'm guessing this is a luxurious bathroom if everybody's trying to use it in the whole family. No,
it's not.
It's not.
No, I'm just a lowly MMA journalist. I don't know what you think I am.
Lowly.
Not
yeah.
that big.
Oh, right? This poor guy. Somebody, hey, we're going to start a GoFundMe on the show for Ariel. Somebody, please, pitch in. Pitch in for our crestfallen friend here. Yeah, I think you do either that move or you just get the towel hamper. You start chucking them in there every single time with complete reckless abandon and say, this is the new way. If you guys are coming in here, I'm just throwing these towels in here. Now they're in a wet pile. They need to be washed. Like, they need to go. But so how many times would you use it, though? You're saying if it's up to you, if you have your druthers, it's just you alone. There's no accidentally using somebody else's towel. This is just Ariel Helwani. He's alone now. He's in a bachelor party. He's on the road.
Yeah.
And he's decided there's no maid. There's no nothing. You're saying less than a week with one towel. Less than
less
1 week.
Three days max.
No,
3 days max.
3 days
and
max.
When I'm at a hotel, it's a new one every day.
Well, hotel. Listen, I'm not telling the hotel, don't worry about it. I'll just keep using the same towel over and over again. No, but at your own home where you have to do the laundry and it's just you
max.
And you have a certainty of it's just you using the towel. 3 days max? Dan Orlovsky, who was your colleague, would make you sick to your stomach because he said 30 days for him.
What?
Yeah.
Are you shitting me? Oh, sorry. I apologize.
That's the fact. That's what he said. 30 days. And the internet is a roar. And my only take here is that I think for most dudes, they use the towel longer than they would ever admit. So you know how in American Pie, they do the numbers of who you've slept with, and if it's a guy or a girl, you adjust the number, right? Like if a guy says he's been with five, then you subtract three, right? I think that this is what I'm going to do with towel math from now on. So you're saying 3 days max. I'm saying it's five. You know, like I'm giving you a little bit of a boost. You're an honest guy.
I can live with five.
Yeah, I know.
No,
I'm just saying.
I'm embellishing this? No. When I was living by myself, when I was in college, whatever, it was 3 days max. And when I was living in a dorm and, you know, like the towel is going with me into the communal bathroom and stuff.
That's different.
It might not even made it to 3 days.
No,
honestly.
That's different.
I'm very weird when it comes to showers. Can I tell you something?
Yeah.
Just a quick story. I know you didn't have me on to talk about all of this.
Yeah, actually I did.
My son, My son, who's in grade five, not fifth grade, as they say here in the States, went to a birthday party last night at the Devil's Lightning game. For some bizarre reason, he got Andrej Palat to sign his sweatshirt. I was like, why do you have him sign your sweatshirt? Well, why not like your ticket stub or something? In any event, I took a shower in the evening, went in my car to pick him up and bring him back from his friend's house afterwards. And because I put on the jacket that I wear outside, I had to take another shower before going to bed.
Yeah, that's too much.
That's the only thing I did. I was annoyed about it, but I was like, I can't go to bed like this. I'm full of germs.
Wow, that's too much. You're doing you got a bit of a Howie Mandel situation going on there. Like, what's the deal?
1,000%.
Okay.
1,000%. I don't want to shake anyone's hand. I'd rather bow. I think it's more respectful.
I like when you. I need to meet you now. I need to see you so you bow in front of me. Take a video of that and be like, "This is." I'll have one of my minions off to the side. I'll be like, "Don't worry, no cameras, no cameras." And then I'll take that bow. I get the handshake thing, even though I am a big handshake guy. I definitely am going to end up being one of those old men who like tries to break a bone in someone's hand as the last feat of strength that I have left. Cause you go, I can't do anything athletic anymore. This is sports to me now is a handshake. I'll definitely become one of those people, but I could never shower that many times. Do you do like you just do a rinse though? Like you're not doing full shampoo, full soap after that.
No, but a little bit of soap. Yeah. Not like, you know,
no.
I feel like you can't
poor
go in
skin, man.
And just rinse.
Pores.
Yeah, oh, I have very dry skin.
It's, yeah, that's pretty clear. That's pretty obvious if you're doing that. Putting on your own jacket. Oh, man, no, you and I would not be able to be roommates. Like, that would just, it's not going to work out. Like, you would be disgusted.
And by the way, this morning, I did a quick, you know, I was stressed for time. You're calling me, you're texting me up the storm, the whole thing. I had to do a quick 20 minutes on the Peloton before my shows. I'm going in today. So I've taken 3 showers in the span of 12 hours.
Yeah. See, I think that's more, I think that's a stranger behavior than using a towel 30 days in a row. Like, I'm closer to Orlovsky than I am to you.
That's fine.
Yeah.
He's a great guy.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I don't think that he should be judged as a person based on his style usage. You know what you should be judged on, though, is if you try to run a bunch of different leagues, you try to start a bunch of businesses, and they all fail. Slap League is dead. And I was worried because I thought that I saw ratings went up maybe, and partially this could be because the week one ratings were so bad. But, yeah, what happened here? Cole's notes of this, because I saw some of your tweets, like the athletic commissioner of Nevada being upset that he decided to actually go with it. It was always surprising to me that it was on network television, that TBS greenlit this. But does this have a future beyond? Because it feels like the UFC and Dana White have actually invested quite a bit into this, and they've taken a big image hit, all this different stuff. To have it be a failure this quickly, what happens here? This is their most public of all the failures.
Here's what I have to say about this. Number one, I think you're one of the best young broadcasters in Canada. Your show is must-listen. It's appointment listening for me. The fact that we are spending time talking about this nonsense of a quote-unquote sport is a little bit shocking. It's one of the rare L's of your career, okay? I just want to let you know this. I can't believe you're even asking me about this nonsense. I just want to apologize to your audience for boring them with this stuff. The Slap League, we all knew it was going to be a failure. This is a 10-second TikTok video that Dana White saw and thought would be a cool thing. They paid TBS a lot of money to put it on there. It was a horrible thing to do for TBS. Even if they got paid, they don't need that money. But nevertheless, the timing was, you know, very unfortunate considering what he did on January 1st. I think they wanted nothing to do with it early on. If you watched AEW beforehand, they promoted it a lot before the incident. Mm-hmm. And then it's on some app that I've never heard of called Rumble, which sounds like a children's like Rock'em Sock'em robot toy. Mm-hmm. And now we're being told that it's going to be moving over there and this is some great success. They flew in all these influencers to sit there and watch it. It's a joke. I saw some clips like, I'm sorry, but these aren't athletes.
Yeah, of course.
And if I'm Merab Dvalishvili, who had this massive win on Saturday over Pyrrhon, former UFC Bantamweight champion, and I see that I'm on like the fifth row of the UFC Instagram because the rest above me is all this slap nonsense, it's ridiculous. And as I said, I will always praise Dana White. I'll always give him this credit for what he did for the UFC. He was the right man for that job. Without him, it's not what it is. He was perfect for it. Everything else that he has done has been a massive failure, not mm-hmm. just a failure. A massive failure.
Yeah.
And this was dead on arrival and, you know, great. Enjoy Rumble. Can you just stop tweeting about it all the time on my feed because it's starting to clog it up for me.
But this is why I brought it up. This is why I'm defending, and I am going to move off of it. This is my show, so I'm going to take the final say on this. I don't think it's a total L just because of the way that the UFC has thrown so much weight behind it and that it just looks really, really embarrassing. When you had TBS and it was sanctioned, you could at least say things like, oh, well, there seems to be an interest in this. And people go, wow, is this one of those things I don't understand, but maybe a different part of the population does? And the fact that they're still not moving off of it and that they're still kind of trying to purport as though it's going to be working and that this Rumble app is going to exist and that they're going to promote it over some of their top athletes.
I
find that very
strange. Because they've dumped a lot of money into this and they're bored. And
but someone
won the
has
race,
to be responsible
and
for
Lorenzo
that.
And Lorenzo is coming back.
Yeah.
Lorenzo's coming back. By the way, you know what? I don't blame them necessarily for trying to find the next thing, and they're using the same playbook all over again. They're doing the tough thing all over again.
Yeah.
Shame on the Nevada Athletic Commission. And shout out to that guy mm-hmm. Who's no longer there who said that this was a mistake.
Yeah.
How these people approve this is beyond me. And it's a real black eye. And I see these MMA referees going from the UFC event on Saturday to this. Shame on all of them for being a part of this. This is not sport. This is a human car crash. If MMA was human cockfighting back in the late 90s, as the late great John McCain once said, what is this? Mm-hmm. And you know what's crazy to me, JD? There's something called bare knuckle fighting. I'm not a huge bare knuckle guy, but you know it's there. It's growing, and a lot of big names are going to them, and they're paying them a lot of things. And God bless, right? And they recently signed former UFC Strikeforce champion Luke Rockhold and former UFC champion Eddie Alvarez. They are fighting on a pretty damn big card on April 29th against fellow former UFC fighters, Platinum Perry and Chad Mendez. Those are big fights.
Yeah,
those are really big, interesting fights. Those guys can't do what they're doing on April 29th in Colorado in the state of Nevada. Nevada won't sanction bare knuckle, but they sanction this? Are you kidding me? Something where you can't defend yourself. Literally can't defend yourself. The whole thing that we've heard over the past couple of years is brain injuries, CTE, protection, defense, da-da-da. Here you are tied to this thing. You cannot defend yourself. How could you, as a commission, as a promoter, be okay with that? Because I'm not as a viewer.
Yeah, neither was I. I found it to be, listen, I'm not Mr. Sensitive, and I didn't like that. You know, I grew up watching skateboard videos. My first favorite YouTube stuff was to watch, the most horrific accents you could find. This was too much for me. I hated Slap League. I couldn't believe it got off the ground. I do wonder where, if ever, there's going to be any accountability for it trying to be, a business venture that doesn't work out. Okay, so we got other things. I'm going to keep it moving now. I thought it was a little surprising that you and I, people who love George St. Pierre very deeply and watch the rise of Kamaru Usman, that it got to this point where GSP was doing both of our shows talking about how, he didn't think that he was the greatest welterweight ever anymore, but that Usman had surpassed him based on the streak that he went on to. And then there was this ton of GOAT debates after John Jones's run here and whatever. I don't care so much about people's opinion on it. I just thought it was interesting always, like, who is in the conversation? Who are the people that we do include in it? And it feels like, for a guy that was dominating a fight against Leon Edwards, I'm not going to call it lucky because it was a great, great strike by Edwards. It was a ton of skill, took a ton of toughness to even be in the fight at that point. But I do think it's a little interesting that, like, Usman has completely fallen out of that discussion, and now he's still, like, on our site, Patano. He's a minus 238 favorite heading into the fight this weekend. Does he recapture some of that? Is that gone forever for you? Why is this?
Well, I think it's a bunch of things. Number one, that finish was so spectacular, right? Yeah. I mean, it was the equivalent of a 50-point half-court shot. It just doesn't exist. Like, you're down three rounds to run. There's a minute left. Your body language is horrible. And then you pull that out of the fire. So it's like one of the most shocking and memorable moments in the history of the UFC. And, oh, by the way, it was against a guy who was looking so dominant and was starting to creep into that conversation. That being said, like, Usman has kind of flown under the radar a little bit. And fair play to him. Like, he's totally allowed to do that. Let his fighting do the talking. He hasn't done a ton of media. He hasn't been out there. He did a couple things here and there, you know, in the aftermath, a TMZ clip here and that. But, like, he's really stayed out of the limelight. Meanwhile, Leon is the face of UK MMA. He's beloved over there. He's the face of every, like, immigrant who comes to the UK. He's from Jamaica. His mom has been through so much, and he's become a darling. And so everyone's all, you know, jazzed up about him. But again, to your point, it is worth reminding people that he's the underdog. Now, I'm surprised he's that big of an underdog, but that could just be people being like, oh, it was a fluke, you know, there's no chance he's going to pull that again. I'm expecting a much better performance out of Leon. There's a few things at play here. Number one, they're not fighting at altitude. Number two, I was hearing he was banged up going into that fight, but everyone is fine. You don't want to use that as an excuse. Number three, first title fight for him. And number four, he's at home. He's never lost at home. And then here's the biggest one of them all. Kamaru Usman is coming off a pretty gnarly knockout. Mm-hmm. And we all know you don't recover from that. You know, like, you change as a person. You change as a fighter when you get knocked out like that. Leon's coming in fresh. You know, like, what's going on in Kamaru's mind? Well, what is he thinking? Is he going to be able to pull the trigger? Is he going to be too nervous, gun shy? All these things. There's a lot of things working against him now. So that's why, like, someone asked me of the four UFC pay-per-views, like, you and I always talk about, are the shows good? Do they have stars? This and that. Like, they're on a great stretch right now. Dating back to Volkanovski, Makhachev, this one, Jones and Gunn a couple weeks ago, and then Izzy and Pereira again on April 8th. Of those four big-time main events, this is the one that I was looking forward to the most. I can't wait.
Yeah, and, they've got John Jones back. They get Cejudo back. It does feel like Conor McGregor's going to fight, and there's going to be a tough that I think starts in May
30th.
That's going to draw a lot of eyeballs. No, the star factor stuff has definitely risen. And I do think that it's actually way more, it's way better for the UFC if Leon Edwards can win this fight and really establish himself as, okay, this wasn't a fluke. You're the real deal. You're the real champion. We've got that corner of the world settled with a superstar. All those things that you just mentioned as to why he's beloved, that's really good for them. Okay, so you had Brandon Gibson on your show. That's John Jones's coach. He was talking to you about how he thinks he could walk away early. Do you think that could happen as early as the Stipe fight? Because I saw some people online going, well, what if he fights Tom Aspinall and he could be dangerous to him? And then there was this stuff that Ngannou was talking to TMZ saying about how he wanted the fight and he's mad that he ducked him. And I just don't see that fight lining up ever. And then I go, well, what does John Jones have to prove? Who is he going to want to beat that's actually a risk to him? If he beats Stipe, do you think it's done?
Well, and by the way, we're live right now, right?
Yeah.
Okay, quick plug. Frank Zingano is going to be on my show today at 2:45 p.m. Eastern.
Nice.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I do think he sticks around. I think this idea, look, I think Stipe wins or loses, he's gone. This is it for him. If they make the fight, by the way, it's not even a done deal, but I suspect they'll make it. Although, you know, they have been known to lowball Stipe, and he said, you know what, I'm not really that interested. So let's see. But let's just assume they make the fight. I think John sticks around. First of all, he's still in his mid-30s. What's he going to do? He's not going to become a broadcaster. He's not going to become a podcaster. Like, what's he going to do? I think this actually keeps him on the straight and narrow. I think he wants to make up for lost time. And now he has an opportunity, without having to win that many times at heavyweight, to establish himself really as the greatest of all time at heavyweight and light heavyweight, right? Because, like, all you have to do is win 3 or 4 title fights. I know I'm saying all you have to do, but, you know, heavyweights, they pass around that title a lot because of how volatile it is. So let's say he beats Stipe. Now, okay, now we're starting to have the conversation. Is he already in there? And then let's say he beats a Curtis Blaydes. And then let's say he beats Tom Aspinall, who I think is going to be a future heavyweight champion and is just like a phenom. And then there's another guy who pops up there. Like, all of a sudden, we're talking 3-4 title defenses. That's a thing. So I don't think July, if they do this fight, or August, I don't think it's the last time we see John Jones. I feel very certain it's the last time we see Stipe. But John has got a lot more left in him, in my opinion, if, of course, he can, you know, stay out of trouble and all that stuff.
So all fighters do this whenever it doesn't happen. But do you think that Jones did duck Ngannou?
Hell no.
Okay.
No, I hate this. I hate this conversation. And I certainly don't think Ngannou ducked Jones. I'm starting to see this hate. Like, today I said that France is going to be on my show. Everyone's like, oh, tell him he's ruining the biggest fight of all time, blah, blah. What are you talking about ruining? He doesn't owe anyone anything. Like, this guy came from nothing. He's going out there. He's trying to get, you know, paid. But he's also living out a dream of being a boxer and all this stuff. And he wants certain things that the UFC contract just won't give him. But Jones didn't do it. When they were talking, quote-unquote, about making this fight, Jones was in a bad spot as far as his UFC contract is concerned. And here's the other thing that no one wants to talk about. You know, you ever notice that at the beginning of the pandemic, like when they were fighting in front of no one truly, UFC was putting on fights. And again, much respect, it turned out to be a brilliant move on their part. But did you notice that they never tried to make like the big, big ones? They never even Conor alludes to it all the time.
No, we've talked about this.
He calls it.
Yeah,
because they couldn't sell tickets. So they didn't want to have Conor fight in front of no one. They didn't want to have John Jones fight in front of no one. They didn't want to have Nate Diaz fight in front of no one. And so John and Francis are doing this thing. They weren't going to waste that fight, which, you know, John's return, what did it do at T-Mobile? Like $14 million gate or something like that. So all they had to do was, all right, cool, Amanda Nunes, Felicia Spencer, get him out there. Oh, this guy, get him out there. But they weren't putting together the blockbuster fights until, you know, fans started trickling in and whatnot. And so, you know, why didn't they make the fight back then? It was because of John's contract. It was because of the pandemic. It wasn't because of Ngannou, and it certainly wasn't because John didn't want it. He was just trying to get a certain deal in order to fight him.
Only downside of doing live is that we're pressed for time, so you only have a minute here. You're on a lot of pods talking about your Knicks. I'm happy for you because you just enjoy it one game at a time. It's a perfect sweet spot as a fan right now what the Knicks are doing. The Bills, they just lost Edmonds, but there was like a cryptic tweet from, I can't remember which receiver, I think it was Isaiah McKenzie. You've got the Bills restructuring contracts, like Josh Allen doing it, Von Miller did it. You've only got about a minute here, a little bit more.
Okay. Right.
What do you want for the Bills? What's your number one wish list? It doesn't have to be a player. It can be a position, whatever you want to do, whatever you want to say. I think that they need like a power running back. I want to see them trade for Derrick Henry.
Oh, my God. I would go nuts if they did that. Listen, I'm nervous. I'm nervous. I was happy to see Leslie Frazier go, but with all due respect, who's the defensive coordinator? Is it McDermott? Okay.
Yeah.
Restructuring, it's not the greatest look, but the okay team dies, great. Losing Edmonds, losing Poyer probably. We did sign Milano, which I'm happy about. Naeem Hines seems to have taken a deal to come back, great. But yes, I mean, the running back situation has always been the biggest weakness, and also the defense, and in particular the run defense, right? Like when Vaughn was there,
it was great. When he left, it wasn't. And Vaughn isn't coming back in September. He's coming back from an ACL. He's probably coming back October, November. Who the hell knows? And so I will admit, I don't feel the same as I did last offseason. I'm a little bit nervous. And with other teams getting better, you know, the Dolphins, obviously the Chiefs are still the Chiefs and others, there is a small negative part of me that wonders if the window closes. I don't want to believe that, but I'm such a negative person that I fear that the window closed last year.
I think every year that you have Josh Allen, you're still going to be a competitor. You're still going to be a contender. And the problems they have, I don't think, are going to be the worst. I still think there's going to be a really splashy move from the Bills very, very soon. Subscribe to the podcast. Leave 5 stars. Couldn't even say bye to Ariel. We were so tied up against the clock. Never do live again, Ariel. All right? Although he did get to plug his show in Ganu today. That's fun. Subscribe to the podcast. Leave 5 stars. Follow on Twitter and Instagram @JD Bunkus. See you tomorrow. If you're in the